Hello, and welcome to 21 and 21. I'm Haley Burko, and today I'm speaking with Alex Gladstein. Alex is the Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation and a powerful advocate for how Bitcoin can empower people living in authoritarian societies. Alex, it's so great to see you again at Presidio Bitcoin.
I love coming here. Love what you guys are doing here.
Well, I always appreciate an Alex visit. You've been here a few times, so and thank you for taking this time to...
Won't be the last.
Great. We love that. I think you've seen this show before, so I'm going to start this clock.
Let's go.
And we're going to get into it. Let's go. Before you came such a strong voice for Bitcoin, what got you into the human rights space?
So, in short, world events. I was in high school during 9/11 and the Iraq war, the American invasion of Iraq, and it made me very curious about the world around me. And I wanted to seek knowledge that would help me interpret and help me understand what was going on. So I started looking at international relations in college. I was actually going to go into hard sciences. I probably would have ended up like one of these engineers here. But I went to international relations and Middle Eastern studies. And I started looking at that part of the world. And that's what led me to my internship at the Human Rights Foundation, was looking at civil liberties stuff. So really the spark was trying to understand the wider world around me.
I guess if you already had an interest in hard science, maybe Bitcoin was kind of the perfect blend of this equation of all of your interests.
I mean, Bitcoin's a mirror. I always say that it reflects back at you what you want to see. And it reflects back at me everything that I want to say. All the things I'm interested in, I can find it in Bitcoin. Yeah, it's been my greatest teacher, I would say. For sure, of any course or college session or seminar, Bitcoin's taught me the most about the world around me.
So you obviously have done a lot, you do a lot, you write, you speak, travel, you put on events. What's some of the things that are most top of mind to you right now?
Well, you all did an event here that looked at the intersection between Bitcoin and AI a few months ago. And that's something I'm pretty consumed with, especially the open source AI tool stuff. How can activists use that? So we've started a new program at HRF that seeks to sort of take the blueprint of what we've done with the Bitcoin program, with the financial freedom program, and then do what worked best with AI tools. So we're going to do two things, kind of like how at the Bitcoin program at HRF, we have a CBDC tracker that tracks the rise of CBDCs all around the world. And we have research that looks at how governments are attacking Bitcoin users. And at the same time, we're just heavily investing in open source Bitcoin work and communities and education around the world. So same thing. We're going to expose and track how governments are using AI to repress people. But we're also going to heavily, heavily invest in and support open source tooling for activists so they can scale their work. And it's probably the thing I've changed my mind the most on. 5 years ago, if you'd asked me, I really thought AI was a communist state control thing that was going to be a disaster for civil liberties. And there still is some of that, obviously. But I'm now so much more bullish on the impact it's going to have for individual freedom.
Well, I was actually going to ask you later on about AI and the intersection with Bitcoin. So I'm glad that you're thinking about it already. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously in San Francisco, AI is like a really hot topic. It's like Sure. Everywhere you look.
But mostly buzzwords.
Mostly buzzwords. Yeah. But also using it a lot as a tool and work, especially kind of on the creative market side, but just in general, like I use AI a lot. I'm curious if you're seeing human activists using AI too, and if so, yes. How?
Well, I think it started with LLMs, right? So just helping with research and writing is huge. I mean, just the fact that you can say, because you have to understand that human rights activists and small NGOs spend a lot of their time reporting to donors and filing grant reports and writing grant proposals, and interacting with their donor base is a huge chunk of their work. And if you're a founder who's really focused on street activism or some sort of creative activism or the thing that you're doing, like environmentalism or investigative reporting or labor rights or whatever it is, it sucks to have to spend all your time raising money and reporting to people. So the fact that now you can just use a state-of-the-art LLM and just be like, hey, please scour the web for the work we've done in the last year and use some of these documents too, and write me a 24-page report on our successes. And then you just send that out. Or, you know, hey, you know, write a letter that goes to the people who support this foundation that's kind of like ours. I want it in this tone, in this style, and I want you to help us raise money with it. And then it's like, it can expand what's possible with a small team by 10x. And that's just the LLM stuff. I think we're getting to the point where, I mean, keynotes, graphic designs, animations, we're not quite there yet, but you can see that within the next year, we'll be there. Like right now, the graphic design stuff doesn't, it's still like confused, but like we're going to get there. And it's just going to wipe out so much of the tedious work that activists have to do. And it's going to make it a joy for them to do that. All the vibe coding stuff is just going to be so huge, I think. So it already is for many. I mean, I've seen activists that don't know how to code. They're already vibe coding stuff that work in protests to coordinate. Like things like the BitChat type idea that Jack created. Other people have created similar things for protests specifically. Like already, like in the last 2 months. So we're excited to be at that intersection of vibe coding for human rights.
It is crazy how much you can do, especially as like a less technical person. So it's incredible to hear that activists can really use AI in ways that can yes. empower them and their productivity and work and impact. So what do you think the ideal role of government is, if any?
Well, that's quite a question. Well, for starters, I like government for the people. I think government should serve its people. And when you think about the word democracy, like the Greek root, I mean, it's really supposed to be people-powered government. And that's very different from an oligarchy or a tyranny or any other, you know, ocracy that you can think of, right? And I think we're on the pathway there. There's no perfection. There's nothing even close, right? But I do think, generally speaking, what we have is in the right direction in a place like America, domestically at least, where you have a federal government in charge of certain things. But a lot really needs to be done, I think, more at the community level, at the local level, at the state level. So I like the fact that we have that kind of system. It's not great when there's like central bureaucracy, like in the EU, that, you know, is making decisions for all these different people, all these different cultures. And that's tough. It leads to tough outcomes. So I think local governance is really important. And I hope to see a world with a lot more local governance. And, you know, at the end of the day, government is there to mediate disputes and to help prevent people inflicting violence on each other. And those are two of its most important roles. And I hope to see a reduction of what the sort of federal government does and maybe stronger local governance structures. So that would be interesting to me.
So kind of on that topic of, you know, local government, the power of Bitcoin, and there's just generally just a lot of narratives around Bitcoin and mm-hmm. how people get into it. Have you seen the human rights angle kind of shift maybe perspective of people, those who are skeptical of Bitcoin or anti-Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure. But it takes an open mind, right? It's, you know, it's like all the arguments about Bitcoin mining. If you think Bitcoin's useless, of course, it's a waste of energy. If you don't understand what it does. So I think the work we do in helping explain to people that it's actually this really revolutionary human rights tool is very important, because once you understand its utility, then you look at things like the power use and the criminality aspects differently. Once you know it's this thing that's so important and we have to work on it, then it changes completely the framework of all the other FUD. Like the FUD dice that Nick Carter once made, you know, has all those things on, all the different FUDs. That really changes once you understand that this thing's of vital importance for civilization. Once you understand that, then we can have different conversations about mining and energy use and criminality and volatility and all these other things. So I think ultimately the human rights piece is important, but people still have to be open to it. There are still so many people in denial who won't even talk about it. They just, you know, they're like, oh, you're just making this up. There's a heavy, heavy amount of salt out there. It's really tough, even today still. But we're winning. I mean, we're getting there. It's like nuclear power. I mean, we're always going to have some deniers. It just sucks that like 90% of the world is still like full on denial mode or ignorant about it. I think in the next decade, that's going to change completely though. And I do think Bitcoin is going to be driven a lot by activism in the same way that technologies like PGP and Signal and then even Twitter itself were. You know, one of Twitter's big moments was the Arab Spring, right? That really turned it from like a microblogging community in San Francisco to like a global events thing. That's what Jack said, and I agree. So I think human rights communities are really going to push Bitcoin too, because they're the ones that really need money that the government can't control.
Yes, it can be hard for people who live in the United States or countries that have more privileges to even see the use case for Bitcoin as much.
We need to check our financial privilege, basically. That's what I think.
Yes. What do you think, like, what's a world on the Bitcoin standard look like to you?
That's a really great question. I think ultimately, as an American, it's a world where we have more of the best sides of our nature as a country and a society, and less of the bad sides of our nature as a society and as a country. I think that in a Bitcoin standard, people have more power over their lives, more power over what they can do with their time. These are huge generalizations, but I believe them to be true, I think. I think the government will be less wasteful in terms of being able to do things like expensive foreign wars in places that the average citizen can't name, crazy sort of militarized policing and industrial prison complexes that the average person doesn't really want to see. There's a lot of excesses in our current system, war on drugs type stuff, massive amounts of surveillance. A lot of this is done without consent of the people because it's been able to be funded by the national credit card. So if that's not possible to do anymore, if spending really requires consent of the people, and if you basically have to tax for it or get them to give you money in the form of bonds, which is how we used to fund warfare back in the day, and we used to fund all these social programs this way, then I think we'll have a more collaborative society that's both more prosperous and dynamic at home, but especially abroad. I do think a Bitcoin standard is going to completely change the way America interacts with the rest of the world. And I think in a good way, I think we have a chance to be a lot more collaborative and less exploitative, with the rest of the world. So I'm super excited about that. And as far as how does it look like specifically, we could just think about the fact that everybody will earn in the same currency. So you won't be able to do this game that companies play today where they pay someone way less in some other country just because they make some other currency. No, everybody's going to earn sats. And you may not, I don't know if we're going to be on chain. I don't know. That's for a different discussion, but I don't know if everybody's going to be on chain, but everybody's going to be denominated in sats, I think, obviously, in a Bitcoin standard. So it's a little different than today you have Naira and dollars and pesos and lira, and governments can devalue people's time in half because they're on different standards, 180 different standards. Under one standard, that's at least one thing you can't do anymore. You can't just like press a red button and just steal from everybody. If everybody's on sats, the idea of currency devaluation goes away. The idea of these overnight massive currency devaluations that billions of people have suffered from go away. So Bitcoin standard does not fix everything, but it does address quite a bit in terms of, I think, fundamental individual human dignity and control over your time and control over the fruit of your labor.
So you just said the word sats.
Yes.
Four times.
Yeah. I'm a sats maximalist.
Okay, you're a sats maximalist. Obviously, there's a lot of talk going on about how we speak about the fractions.
Yes, sure.
So your team sats?
I mean, I would confess that it's not at my top of my priority list, and I don't mind either way. I would just observe that it's an organic phenomenon, and I don't see any issue with sats. Like, if you look at how the dollar and the dollar system evolved with denominations, you know, it used to just be, you'd walk into a store and it'd be like one or two, or they wouldn't even say what cents or dollars. It was just like a thing, and it changed over time. So we'll see. I don't think it's one of the biggest priorities. Not an obstacle in my mind. Like, people do not get a Human Rights Act. This is not something that somebody actually gets confused about that I've seen. But no, maybe other people have different experiences.
So they know the difference between sats and Bitcoin, and it's not confusing.
If you depend on it, you learn pretty quickly. Yeah, that like 100 million sats is different from 100 million Bitcoin, which doesn't exist. So yeah, but it's got to take someone. If someone's actually like using it in their business, or they're sending money to a friend abroad, they'll have to learn about that. It's not that complicated in my view. Plus, I like honoring Satoshi, so we'll see.
So leaning more into people using Bitcoin as a form of money or just relying on it, what are some of the UX challenges that you've heard from activists in regards to Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, going back a few years, the idea of like a Bolt 12 offer or a Lightning address was something that was really wanted back in the day, like 3, 4, 5 years ago when we started doing this work with activists, I guess more than that now. And those exist now, which is super cool. Like, the idea of a Lightning address is very helpful. And having alphanumeric Bolt 12, really cool. 12 cache type stuff if you can rig it up the right way. I think what we need now is more like, you know, because Bitcoin is like this push system or whatever. So more of something where it's like you're on the internet and you want to donate or buy something, you can just have your alphanumeric identity or email or whatever it is set up in such a way where it can be almost like debited from. That's obviously not what's really happening because Bitcoin doesn't really work like that, but that it's plugged in some way where you don't have to generate, do an invoice every time and interact with it. Like, definitely the invoices have improved a lot since a while ago, but the ideal world is one where you're not, you can load something in that's some sort of static identity, at least, that doesn't betray your secrets, that can just be like interacted with by merchants, you know? So that would be the next level for me, like if we could get there. And I know some people have already gotten there in some ways, which is cool. Like using Bitcoin as money is so much easier than it used to be. Like whether you use Strike or Cash App on the custodial side, or like Albi on the self-custodial side, and you're like, I was just buying something on the internet yesterday with Lightning, and I was just so shocked by how easy it was. Just go to the store, threw the thing in my shopping cart, put in where I wanted it to be shipped, and then hit pay, and then scanned the code, and it was done. And it was just amazing. And that was not the case 5 years ago. So we've made a lot of strides, I think,
towards
Bitcoin being money that we can actually use. And I think what Square is going to do with the readers is going to be really interesting. Like, that's going to start to get very exciting. And I'm going to be spending a lot of Bitcoin. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
I'm excited for it, too. So HRF does a lot with funding open source contributors.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say kind of some of the biggest learnings of the grant program have been?
Well, at first it was like hard to find good projects in 5 years ago when we started the program. Now it's like a deluge of people coming to us with ideas. And there are way too many ideas that, you know, than we can possibly fund is what I've learned, is that the space is really maturing. Whereas 5 years ago, you didn't have that many Bitcoin educational initiatives in South America. Like, that just didn't really exist. Today, there's dozens and dozens and dozens, right? So they keep multiplying every day all around the world. Translation projects, hubs, spaces like Presidio Bitcoin, places like local hosts that are supporting local developers, UX design projects, merchant adoption stuff. Each world region has so much of that each going on. And we just see it in the deluge of cool projects that get submitted to us. Cold storage, multi-sig, all kinds of interesting stuff. New wallets that do different things. All kinds of Lightning and eCash things. Complementary tech with Noster. It's just, it's dizzying now. So what I've learned is that the space has like really matured, and the number of people dedicating their lives to Bitcoin and Bitcoin-related stuff is orders of magnitude more than it was in, let's say, before the pandemic. You know, it just, we've really, really matured. So big lesson there.
Any specific projects that are doing impactful stuff that you want to shout?
I mean, I really like what Africa Free Routing is doing and what BTC Data are doing in Africa. I mean, Africa Free Routing, you should follow them. They're like doing these incredible live boot camps where you take developers and they start hacking Lightning, and there's 20, 30, 40, 50 people in the room, and they were in Benin and now they're going to be in Zambia and they're going all over the continent. It's amazing. And those people are all going to have skills that they can, especially with AI tools, that now they can like work for companies abroad and they can get paid in sats, or they can at least do stuff with companies like Stackwork where they can do micro jobs. Like, it's getting very exciting. Like like a Replit equipped Lightning engineer anywhere who can get paid in Bitcoin, you know, can start basically competing with someone who just got a PhD from Stanford. Like, it's getting really exciting on that front. BTC Data does work with helping women in different communities in Africa learn how to use Bitcoin, how to save in it, and how to use it as a sword and a shield, basically, to fight for their place in society. So those two projects are just sort of totally next level, I think. And hopefully we see a lot more like that.
Couple more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
A few more questions.
Yeah.
So I have to get at least one spicy question for you. Do you have any controversial Bitcoin opinions?
Controversial Bitcoin opinions. Well, obviously it was very controversial that I thought it was, there's nuance, but that I didn't think that a simping for Bukele was like a good idea. That one, I got a lot of heat for that one. That one's probably been the toughest. I mean, from day one, I was very excited about the Bitcoin law in El Salvador, in as much as I just think if you're going to have legal tender, I mean, we should, any country that has legal tender, we should definitely have Bitcoin as legal tender also. So I thought that was a step in the right direction. And I thought it was just going to be interesting and cool for there to be like an open environment for the support of things like remittances and Bitcoin and things like that. But at the same time, I had observed to that point that this leader was showing a lot of authoritarian signs, and those have really obviously amplified. And, you know, I went there 4 years ago, and since then he's like, you know, basically gotten rid of term limits, dismantled any possible opposition, murdered opponents. It's getting really dicey down there. So, from a civil liberties point of view, like, don't get me wrong, he's clearly presided over a lot of security and safety, but those are not the same thing as freedom. They're different things. So the question is, can you do both? Which is really what you want in a society. You want to be free and safe. You don't just want to be safe, and you don't just want to be free. You want both. And I just don't think that that model's gonna do well. And that's been a very spicy take, because everybody loved him for the Bitcoin stuff. But to be honest, like, yeah, I mean, he's bought some Bitcoin, but we don't know who controls it. We don't really know how much he has. Who's got the keys? It's taxpayer money. The taxpayers have no control over it. So it's been, you know, and then it's been super disappointing that he started taking money from the IMF and now is scrapping a lot of the Bitcoin stuff that I thought was most exciting in the first place. None of the mining really came to fruition. There's no Bitcoin city. So a lot of these things were promises that he very wisely made because he got super famous and it was sexy to be the Bitcoin dictator or whatever. But I think a lot of that stuff's falling away, and we're seeing, you know, that, you know, maybe the commitment to Bitcoin is not really what it once was. But at least he's not shitcoining, I guess. That's a positive.
That is a positive. Okay, one more question, and we'll have it be a positive one.
Okay.
What gives you the most hope for Bitcoin's future?
I think that each adoption cycle, like we're in right now, another cycle, brings in a whole new wave of new people who weren't in Bitcoin before. And they add incredible things to Bitcoin. Absolutely incredible. And I still believe this, that in 2050, when, if there is still a Time magazine or whatever, we'll see, legacy media. But let's say Time magazine still exists and it's still doing like top 10 lists or whatever. When Time magazine does its top 10 most important people in Bitcoin's history, I still think that 6 or 7 of those people at least aren't in Bitcoin yet. I think they're going to come in through these adoption cycles. They might be entrepreneurs, industrialists, designers, developers, doing stuff at a civilizational level that today are like not interested in Bitcoin. But the next cycle, the one after that is going to bring everybody in. So I'm most excited for all the human capital that's going to be drawn into this project that we're all working on together, and how it's going to drive us even further. And that's just something I'm super, super bullish about.
I love that answer, and especially, you know, emphasizes that people aren't too late and there's
not
so
at all.
More.
We're at the beginning, early innings here. Early innings. Remember that. Like 99% of UX designers still aren't working on Bitcoin. 99% of developers still aren't working on Bitcoin. Like we're not there yet.
We're not there yet, but
good start though. Good start.
We're doing good.
Yeah,
we're
yeah,
good
yeah.
start. Well, that was the last of my questions that I have time for.
Mm-hmm.
So, for our listeners, if they want to reach out to you, where can they learn more? Any suggestions, books they should read?
Sure. So you can go to hrf.org and check out our financial freedom page if you want to learn about our programs or webinars or grants. You can follow me on X at Gladstein. I also, in my profile, have my Nostra NPub if you want to follow me on a better social network that can't be stopped, where you have your control over your data and identity and choice over what client to use. Go over there. And then you can take a look at some of my books, check Your Financial Privilege or Hidden Repression, and hopefully some new stuff I have coming out soon. So thanks for having me on.
Of course. You're always welcome here.
Amazing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.